Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last time we were talking about the general crisis of rail in the years after World War II, and we were commenting about how the war itself, which had squeezed liquidity, hit the profits of companies, led to an enormous backlog of maintenance, as well as, you know, great damage itself. And in some countries had seen more ascendant trade unions becoming more active. We talked about how that had left a decade of problems. And of course, we move on this time to Britain, because the period we're talking about is most famous for the beaching cuts. But let me give you a bit of context. Last time, as I pointed out, I mentioned that there was nationalisation of rail in Britain under the post-war Attlee government. Part of a more general process of nationalisation, nothing specific to rail, but also part of a corporatism which did not make it easy to think about how to, as it were, manage effective labour relations, because Labour's corporatism, and it has to be said the Conservatives continued much of this in the 50s, was one that was to a degree rested on paying possibly too much attention to the trade unions. Anyway, in this context, it's not surprising that in many states, rail lines judged less important suffered from limited investment. There was, after all, only so much to go round, which in turn proved a prelude to cuts in networks and servicing. So the most obvious example for us in Britain is the beaching process in Britain, but there were major reductions, it's worth bearing in mind, in other countries, especially America. And it's very foolish to just think of this as a specifically British thing. Indeed, you can look at other countries as well. If you look at a rail map of Belgium in 1950 and a rail map of Belgium in 1980, you will see exactly the same process going on without anybody called Dr. Beeching being there. In Britain, a government-imposed ban on fare and freight increases had led to a serious fall in net earnings in 1945-7. I think it's fair to say it was stupid, it squeezed liquidity, it was, what a surprise, a primarily political decision. And share values, including that of the profitable Southern Railway, fell on the anticipation of nationalisation by the Labour government, which indeed occurred in 1948. Alongside a major increase in goods traffic as a whole, the proportion moved by road rose from 37% in 1952 to 58.3% in 1964. In turn, warehousing and distribution increasingly responded to supplies being carried by lorries. The rail network itself was moving from steam to diesel, but steam remained important, and not only on branch lines. And steam, as I've already mentioned, had very high labour requirements and therefore expensive labour requirements. In 1959, the locomotive Sir Nigel Gresley, built in 1937 and in the same series as Mallard, set a new post-war steam speed record of 112 miles per hour. It was to be withdrawn from service in 1966, but at that time, in 1959, to the non-expert, the person that never looked at the balance sheet, the future seemed possibly good. Of course, there was a switch to diesel for many mainline services, and diesel offered major operating conveniences, not least in working gradients going uphill, which would challenge steam pressure, and also in saving labour. So if you wanted to get a steam train to operate, you needed a substantial workforce: firelighters, lubricators, drivers, firemen. I mean, these days, of course, you see it in heritage railways, which is great, but the vast majority of people in heritage railways are providing their labour for free and are not being paid a pension on top of that. As a working proposition, not such a good idea. Whereas with diesel, what you needed were drivers. However, the strength of trade union opposition to change, as well as firmness over pay differentials and working practices, as in the 1955 17-day national strike, helped undercut the significant investment that was made in the railways. And you could argue the same thing is true in Britain at the present day. Despite relatively strong freight and passenger usage in the 1950s, I've mentioned the percentage of freight being carried fell, but because there was a major expansion in freight, there was still, on the national level, there was still a significant amount going by rail. The operating deficit of British Rail increased from 16.5 million in 1956 to 104 million in 1962, and that's when 104 million meant something. Although how much was lost was depend on which accounting convention is used, which is a point more generally the case when assessing rail financing. In the early 60s, 1960s, the Treasury, which under Macmillan was adopting a sort of modernisation agenda, modelled in part upon what was seen as the way in which the state was helping to modernise countries like France, pressed for clear financial targets and for economic charges by nationalised industries in order to limit and hopefully drive down their debt and investment requirements and the pressure thereby put on the rest of the economy through higher public expenditure, particularly at a time when economic growth was modest. Now, that's important because, in essence, nationalised industries greatly expanded the debt possibilities, requirements, obligations, depending upon which criteria we're going to use, both aggregate and in terms of annual interest payments accrued by the government. And that obviously put pressure on the rest of the economy. And, you know, we're familiar with that today. We live in a world of never, never finances today in which people seem to ignore this. But we, if you think about it, we're familiar with it now. I mean, obviously, if you're going to invest, let us say, 11 billion in public transport and you invest 10 billion of that in railways, then you have far less available for buses and so on and so forth. It had been obviously thus in the 50s and early 60s. There were already cuts to the network in the 1950s. In Devon, where I live, the Princetown line, the line up to Dartmoor, was cut in 1956. The Teen Valley line in 1958, although the process of closure was not immediate. For example, the branch line to Moreton Hampstead on Dartmoor was closed to passenger service in 59, but freight continued. The line was closed only to freight in 64, and a last special passenger train ran in 1970, after which part of the track was lifted. In the meanwhile, a major transformation was proposed. The reshaping of British railways in 1963, a report better known after Dr. Richard Beeching, the chairman of the British Transport Commission and the first chairman of the British Railways Board, has remained controversial to the present day. Speaking for the government in the House of Lords, Viscount Hailsham, the Lord President of the Council, said that new, and a figure who wanted to be Prime Minister, he was one of the people who sought to succeed Macmillan in 63, said that new investment alone was not the answer. Quote, this is from parliamentary records, a system which was built in the main about 1855 or before and designed for purposes then needs redesigning. One third of the system is not really being used adequately at all. The people, whether they are consigners for freight or potential passengers, are voluntarily deserting the railways in droves and taking to the roads. The flexibility of road transport, the danger for rail is the force of inertia. What we have to do is to design a 20th century rail system. That theme, ensuring a modern system, was an established part of the rhetoric of rail, one that was frequently repeated and was important to British government in this period. After all, in the early 60s, it lay behind the first attempt to join the European Economic Community, the forerunner to the European Union, and attempts at national economic planning. It is foolish and feckless for people to treat the Beeching report separate to that. The context is very important. The focus on in the report was on a core network, one made possible and necessary by the move from steam to diesel. In other words, only part of the network, it was believed, would be able to take, be appropriate to take diesel trains, and one designed to provide speed, efficiency and profit. However, rural and small town Britain changed as railways that had integrated it into an urban centred network and therefore fed passengers and freight accordingly were removed, and branch lines were ruthlessly culled. As a result, largely rural areas such as East Anglia, Lincolnshire, Mid Wales, the Welsh Borders, North Cornwall and the Isle of Wight were left with few or no services. In Devon, the lines that closed included all of those in West Devon, the Exe Valley line, the line from Exmouth via Budleigh, and those from Taunton to Barnstaple and from Barnstaple to Ilfracombe. In Scotland, there were extensive closures, including in the Borders, in southwest Scotland and in northeast Scotland, and the line north of Inverness was only reprieved through political lobbying. That was important, but that wasn't the sole issue with provision. In particular, on a long-standing pattern, and one that has continued to the present, the concentration on links that survived on routes into London, axial routes, was not matched by the necessary attention to lateral ones, in other words, cross-country services. Thus, Trans-Pennine services were and are inadequate, as are those euphemistically called cross-country, including the one from Exeter up to Newcastle, and others, for example, Bristol to Weymouth, Great Yarmouth to Liverpool, Birmingham to Cambridge. Similarly, double track lines became single track, as with most of the Salisbury to Exeter line in 1967, and that reduced the frequency of usage, essentially, where there were passing places. On that line, there's passing place, for example, at Yeovil, trains could pass it just outside Tisbury. Trains could pass each other, but most of the place they track they couldn't, which meant that you could only run one train at a time. There was also devastation-style rebuilding of railway stations, for example, at Euston, and threats to redevelop other stations, such as Liverpool Street. Many stations themselves closed during this period. So both the stations, obviously, where there was no longer a train, I mean, Budleigh Salterton, for example, but stations also where the train still ran, but there was no longer a station left. So Clumpton, for example. On top of that, railway works at major sites such as Darlington and Swindon closed. The last pickup of mail post by a moving train was made in 1971. Thereafter, mail was only brought to rail stations by road, and aircraft and lorries were increasingly used to move the post. So much for the W.H. Auden poem, the night mail. However, that was bad enough. At least the dramatic cuts suggested as options in the 1982 report by Sir David Serple, the former permanent secretary at the Ministry of Transport, were rejected. One option, the headline one, would have reduced the system by 84%, essentially to a few major routes, notably from London to Cardiff, Newcastle and Scotland. But, really a very parlous system. To Scotland, it would only have been possible to go via Manchester. There were no trains in this option designed to run north of Newcastle. The parliamentary discussion in 82 led one parliamentarian to claim that Britain seemed one of the few Western democracies which is behind in placing emphasis on the need for a strong rail system, but other speakers drew attention to the cost of the taxpayer and to archaic working practices on the part of the rail unions. Instead of these cuts, in fact, the system, with passenger numbers reviving from the mid-1980s, stabilised at just over half the interwar mileage. This, of course, stripped out a lot of capacity, but it also reduced the mileage that had to be maintained and the attendant costs. And it has to be said that the National Union didn't actually improve its, shall we say, political clout by striking or in support of the coal miners. Whereas the number of 1,000 million passenger miles by rail had fallen from 24.2 in 1952 to 20.5 in 76, it rose to 25.5 in 1950. But that was as part of against the background of a rising population, and these figures were totally dwarfed by those for car, taxi and motorcycle, 33.6 1,000 million passenger miles in 1952, but 352.9 in 1990. And of course, the construction of a motorway system, which had begun in 1958, helped to make rail seem yesterday's story. Although, to be fair, there were significant new initiatives, such as the 125 trains running from 1976, and indeed the electrification of the line, the main East Coast line, to Newcastle and also to Leeds. Now, I want to pause there and talk a bit to Graham, and then I want to talk a bit about the images of rail in this period. Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. I was interested in the point you made about seeing the beaching axe in terms of contemporary ideas about the importance of planning, rationalisation, joining the European Economic Community and other signs of modernization. It seems to me, and with apologies for a very poor pun, to what extent is there a twin track here between phasing out steam trains, bringing in diesel? So modernization in terms of the train locomotive technology and the rationalization of train lines exemplified in Dr. Beeching's proposals. Are these two parallel tracks, which nevertheless were independent of one each other, but coincided? Or actually, is there some kind of link between moving forward with diesel technology and axing less economic or uneconomic train lines?
Oh, yes. And the latter was seen, as I mentioned, not only in Britain. I mean, one of the problems is so much of the debate is a specific to Britain debate, which isn't tremendously helpful. And, you know, you can look at how the steam system had practical problems. I've already mentioned the working gradients. I've already mentioned high labour costs. And like a lot of the 19th century legacy, things which had made sense when you had large amounts of available labour, which didn't really go on strike often or at all, things like the army, very large infantry force, very large nursing force, very large labour force on the railways, all of those become more problematic. And of course, one of the responses is to move to mechanisation. And you see this classically with the military. In the case of rail, I mean, there are practical questions about whether it was sensible to strip out what in effect were feeders. But on the other hand, and this is easily available. You can look at this online. The Beeching report came with a whole series of maps. Indeed, I reproduce one of those maps in my book, History of Britain in 100 Maps, with maps which showed freight use, passenger use, and showed the point that parliamentarians made, that most of the system was not really used. And yet, obviously, that system had to be maintained. And whereas, you know, if it was a question of a minor branch line with a few clapped out people of my age and a sort of redundant steam train, you might say the marginal costs were quite modest. The practicality was, now you've got national wage scales that were quite ambitious, you've got safety requirements, and you've got demands for new equipment. So all of which are significant. And that at a time when Britain has a a whole host of requirements on state expenditure, particularly in the early 60s, an interest under both the Macmillan government and then later under Wilson, under Labour, in using the state to spend a lot of money to fund regional development, to fund new industries, the so-called white heat of technology. And rail, I mean, this is why I want to move on in my next section to images. Rail doesn't seem to quite cut it. I mean, there are, in fact, new innovations in railways, and I mentioned last time the use of containerization. And in fact, one of the beaching ideas, and again, they produce a map about this, and there is a subsequent report that very much focuses on this, is the idea that you should have a central rail freight system with modern marshalling yards using and deploying technology, essentially low manpower technology machines to move containers, and that's what freight should be around, freight liners. And, you know, you shouldn't really be taking part in the kind of activity using freight that, you know, as it were, a whole host of separate items put into a baggage cart as if you were in the late 19th century. I'm not saying what one might think or what one might not think, but the key element is there was only so much money. However, and you could argue that many of the people who favour the continuation of the status quo in hindsight were people who never explained where you were going to get the money from to pay for both modernisation and legacy systems.
So just before we move on, let me run with that last point. To what extent was this process in the 1960s a source of party political division? The Macmillan governments and then the Labour-Wilson governments had broadly similar support for the senior management of British Railways pursuing these policies of rationalisation and modernisation, or was there a party political divide and different attitudes as to what the right role for the railways should be?
Well, I mean, Labour was closer to the rail unions, but essentially both sides believed in modernisation. I mean, I think that there are commonalities in a support for economic planning in the early 1960s. Now, as we know, it goes hopelessly wrong. I'm not saying that the alternative would necessarily have been better. That's a counterfactual. But it goes hopelessly wrong under Labour, which is revealed in office to be incompetent and stronger on images and creating new ministries than actually on achievement, and which, of course, diverts a lot of money from the real economy towards both labour costs, which aren't affordable, and also to health and social welfare costs. But the practicality is the Tories had signed up for exactly the same. And it's worth bearing in mind that both, as an aspect of this, both political party leadership supported joining the European Union, which was seen as a form of modernisation. As indeed, if you go on through the 1960s, devaluation of the currency, the Tories criticised abandoning the military presence east of Suez, but the practicality is when Heath came in 1970, that's what they, you know, that's what they did as well. So there was more similarities than one tends to imagine. A major difference, though, is the extent to which policy under Labour was overly influenced by trade unions.
But you can see one aspect of the modernisation, can't you, in the treatment of the railway architectural heritage, the destruction of Euston Station, magnificent station, and its arch, the almost the destruction of St Pancras Station, which was saved up by preservationists led by John Betjeman and others, and it's almost like a willful desire to destroy the kind of historic fragment and to show that there's a brave new world ahead.
Oh, yes. And you get lots of ugly new railway stations. Now, that had already been occurring in the 50s. And again, in some cases, you've got bomb damage. But other traditional stations are either, in some cases, they leave the facade and make a horrible mess behind. Some cases, they destroy the facade. You know, Oxford Railway Station looked pretty awful. I mean, there's lots of pretty awful railway stations from the period, and it's a horrible contrast with some of the quality of earlier building.
So let's move on. You wanted to take the story beyond the early 1980s, where, I mean, almost we have this plan to reduce the rail network to a, you know, a skeleton of a few main lines. That's rejected by the Thatcher government.
What I want to talk about now is more generally the image of rail, more generally, not just in Britain, more generally. And I want to start off by winding us back to the 50s. And I want to look at a famous film, or to my mind, a famous film, Alfred Hitchcock's film North by Northwest in 1959, in which Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint as the two protagonists have a journey on the 20th Century Limited Express, which ran from New York to Chicago from 1902 to 1967. And this is shown as a romantic, it's the Americans present it as the most famous train in the world. It had certainly been the most profitable train in interwar America, as well as the most luxurious. And it didn't require elucidation. So you get remarks. I mean, I noticed this. I like detective novels. And I was recently rereading Rex Stout's Fleur de Lance of 1934. And you get remarks such as, if the Century was on time, it was already at Grand Central. In other words, you would know, the assumption is, you would know what the timetable was of the 20th Century Limited. The service, however, didn't survive the 60s. So also with music. In the 40s and 50s, going by train, we've already referred two times ago to the Chattanooga Choo Choo, was important, as in the Blue Standard Night Train, released in 1952. Less so, I think it's fair to say, by the time that you've got to 1960s singers. A very different form of railway journey as entertainment was provided by Walt Disney, who was born in Marceline, Missouri, a town dependent on the railway. And at Disneyland, his theme park in Anaheim, California, which was developed from the mid-50s and visited by yours truly in 1988, the entire perimeter was encircled by the steam-powered 5/8 scale Santa Fe and Disneyland Railroad ride. There were also railways within the park, taking visitors into nature's wonderland, with a narrow gauge mine train operating in 1956 and thereafter. Railways were also prominent in other theme parks, some of them later, such as Legoland in Denmark, which I visited in 94, I think it was. So, railways were still very significant as forms of entertainment, but they were increasingly marginal for the experience of large numbers of people. And what is interesting is that although luxury train services and indeed the rail as a whole, passenger service as a whole, was hard hit as a percentage of travel, the relative decline of rail travel didn't end its hold on the popular imagination. But what's interesting is that that attention focused on the now discarded system of steam trains and, to a lesser extent, classic diesel trains. Preservation groups and other enthusiasts reopened a few lines and stations, notably in Britain and America, with the, I apologise to Welsh listeners, the Tawilyn Railway in Wales in 1951 and the Festiniog Railway, originally a Welsh slate railway in 1955. But these reopened lines, like the ones from Taunton to Minehead or the one from Totnes up towards the A38, did not link directly into a wider network. Steam trains played a major role in films and television programmes. For example, the British television series Poirot from 1989 to 2013, in which the trains were spared the many problems and decline of Agatha Christie's lifetime. 1890 to 1976, she'd been bitten by bedbugs on the Simplon Orient Express. Rail was also written into plots, as in Downton Abbey, a television series in which Robert Earl of Grantham loses his wife's money in the Grand Trunk Railway, a real Canadian company that, due to poor management, including investment in expensive hotels, defaulted on loan payments in 1919 and was in effect nationalised in 1919 to 1923. Very differently, and based on the London Underground, the satirical and, to those not in the know, baffling game Mornington Crescent appeared on the BBC radio quiz satire I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue from 1978. Model railways, of course, had developed from the 1890s, but they became less prominent with the rise of cars. When I was a child, I liked going to Hamleys, the leading London toy shop, which had a large working model railway system in a prominent place, but unfortunately, it's been removed. Instead, in 2014, the store provided a fake central line tube map with a branch to the store's basement display of part of a real train line. So, I think it's fair to say that the image was out of line with reality. But let's look elsewhere in the world, because this isn't always the case. In communist states, there were car industries, those who visited communist states will recall what a communist car was like, but there was no increase in car use comparable to that in the West. Instead, there was a stress on freight rather than passengers and on railway construction as a means to spread development, for example, in the Soviet Union east of the Urals. This geographical pattern was a lasting theme in the Soviet period, during which long-range rail freight was practically an article of faith. Alongside the communist commitment to electrification, there continued to be steam services, not least due to the cost of new locomotives. Indeed, with plentiful coal, Poland retained many regular steam services into the 1990s. And in China, although it officially ended steam locomotion in 2002, it retained some services where the gradients, the slopes, were a challenge. Rail was seen as a way to integrate the communist world for freight, passengers, and the military. And services were established accordingly. For example, from Moscow via Warsaw to East Berlin, and in 1972, the Leningrad Express also to East Berlin. There was also a Moscow to Vienna service. In contrast, passenger transport across the Iron Curtain was less common, although it was comparatively easy for Westerners if your papers were okay, as I discovered in both 1978 and 1980. Until Russian troops withdrew in 1994, a special military train regularly operated between Moscow and East Berlin. Whereas passenger numbers and freight were affected in the capitalist world by the emphasis on cars and aircraft, in the communist world, rail remained far more significant. So that whereas in the by the 1970s, French tourists overwhelmingly went to the Med by road, in contrast, East German workers went by the Leipzig-Varna Express via Prague and Bratislava to the Bulgarian Black Sea resorts. I got on that train at Brno in 1978, and I was amazed that it ran into the station on time. I was on my way to Bratislava in Budapest, and I found myself in a crowded carriage full of Germans, and in my schoolboy German, I said to them how amazed I was that the train was on time, and they looked at me and told me it was running 24 hours late because of delays at the border. Anyway, So as a result of all of this, the end of communist rule in 1989 to 91 was to represent a major change for the global position of rail. Elsewhere, uncompetitive lines could be kept in operation due to political support and government subsidy, which was a common process. For example, far from being communist, in South Africa, the white minority apartheid regime that ruled until 94 drew heavily on support from farmers in the Transvaal and the Orange Free State, and as a result developed and maintained an uneconomic network that moved farm goods. It would have been far better to just close these and moved everything by truck. These involved far lower revenues than the movement of coal and iron from mines to ports. Phrased differently, competition, wherever you were looking, was politically defined and constrained, albeit not as clearly in communist states. Cold War politics in the broader sense, as well as the Cold War itself, therefore had a profound effect on the fortunes of rail. Now, there were improvements in some countries. If you look at Australia, fiscal pressures during World War II had continued the financial squeeze of the Depression. But from the 50s, a determined effort was made to address the issue of variable gauges. And there was also the opening of new lines, notably the completion of a standard gauge Sydney to Perth railway in 1969 and an Adelaide to Darwin one in 2004. The latter is the route of the GAN train. I mean, this was impressive. Freight is key to the Australian system following the development of long-range bus services as well as domestic air routes and even more significantly cut-price domestic air routes. And indeed, the extent to which in Australia, apart from urban commuting in the major conurbations, particularly around Sydney and Melbourne, rail is not the answer for passengers was clear. For my visits to Australia, I've been there, I think, five times. Although I'm a rail enthusiast, I took aircraft for the long journeys, and this was a typical response. Moreover, due to a variety of factors, but principally those of politics and also a lack of critical mass, many countries gave up rail completely. Barbados in 37, Bermuda in 48, Cyprus in 51, Mauritius in 64, Trinidad in 68, Libya in 65, and so on. And what's worth bearing in mind is that these were not unique, and some places, such as Kitts and Kitts, for example, only a tourist line was to remain. And indeed, if you look at those countries I've just talked about, it's quite clear that it was regarded as, you know, they tried to run it to keep the railways going, but the profit that they could sometimes make, for example, in Bermuda, couldn't handle depreciation or the replacement of equipment tracks and in particular bridges. And as a result of that, in the case of Bermuda, the government purchased the railway, but the cost of improving it led the government itself to abandon the railway and to turn instead to buses, the line becoming a walking route. In Lebanon, closure, which was final in 97, was more chaotic with the civil war and foreign invasion by Syrians causing major damage, not least explosions, and the selling of part of the track for scrap metal. Already the Beirut-Damascus line was closed in 76. So in other words, alongside new beginnings, there was a marked recession. And that remains the case to the present. And that despite the huge rise in the world's population. Now, what we're going to do next time is talk about changes over the last half century. And we're going to start off by looking at China, and then we're going to look at continental Europe. We're going to consider, for example, France and Germany and Spain. And we will also talk a bit more about Britain. But what I wanted to do, and this is the conclusion to this one, is to actually locate the beaching cuts, not in something unique to Britain, but as part of a more general crisis of rail in this period. And I think those people who act as protagonists for highly expensive systems, and I personally am a rail enthusiast, but I think one has to be disciplined here, and most people are totally undisciplined. If you wish to argue for things, whether they are whatever, I mean, you know, you might take different views on the funding of public transport and health services, on the military, you know, whatever you wish to do that, you have to really explain why you should see the one you're arguing as a really special case. And also it helps if you explain where the money is to come from elsewhere and try and build up a political constituency accordingly. In the case of many of these countries, including Britain, the headline, which is that there was value to be gained from the use of rail, important value, needs to be matched by the reality that as a percentage of the people and goods transported, rail was less and less consequential. Thank you very much.
Well, that's the point to leave it there, Professor Jeremy Black, but we will look forward to the next episode. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.